Hello and welcome to Liberal Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know right now if you're driving innovation across the worlds of business, design, tech, and culture. Today I'm joined by Nick Sherrod, co-founder and fellow colleague at Liberal Sessions. Hi, Nick.
Hello. Welcome.
And we're also joined by a wonderful new Liberal mate, Brendan Edgerton. Brendan is a product sustainability strategist who helps organizations turn regulatory demands and shifting customer expectations into innovation and competitive edge. With experience leading at the World Business Council for Sustainable Development and more recently 3M, Brendan is the person you call when you need to operationalize sustainability. Hi, Brendan. How are you?
Hello. Good. Doing fine. Thank you.
According to BNP Paribas, nearly 9 out of 10 institutional investors globally report that they are not changing their commitments to sustainable investing, despite geopolitical pressures. Last year, we were told by many people that the lack of political pressure would mean that all these commitments would be backtracked. So, how is it that sustainability leaders in finance have been so successful in keeping their institutions true to the commitments that they've made?
So I actually think it's a really interesting story as to how resilient financial institutions have been around their climate commitments. Been, like you say, the expectations of it were quite low. Also, interestingly, even if you compare it to some of the commitments they made around workplace diversity and such, like ESG just seems to have been a much stronger case in terms of sustainability. I think in terms of the resilience, I think it's interesting, which is financial systems are different from some other types of industries, which is actually once they have made formal commitments, there is a sense of a need to follow through, especially given how global the most financial institutions are. So therefore, the reporting commitments and such, like the fall off a back of a commitment, are quite much harder to get out of. I also think, though, I think one of the things that's interesting for the wider sustainability world to learn from is the fact that actually the argument in the financial services sector more broadly has been based less on kind of encouraging everyone to move as a movement for a sort of straightforwardly positive reason, and been more around managing the risk that is inherent in the science that's there. And that seems to have also been part of the reason for the success from a resilience standpoint in financial institutions. I don't think it is that leadership teams in banking and insurance and financial services more broadly are more intuitively close to the climate change agenda than other sectors. I think it's firstly that the commitments they've made are much more entrenched and official than they were in other sectors. And also because the sector has understood this as a risk issue. Like the fact that there's going to be changes in the world means that there's a real risk for financial services in different areas. And ultimately, you know, it's a big argument to say that actually most innovation that happens in big companies of all kinds is actually about risk mitigation. Risk is really what big institutions respond to in a big way. And I think the financial services world has really understood that risk, and certainly understood that in a global sense, when a lot of the kind of movement against ESG as such is quite located at the moment in terms of in North America. And so therefore the kind of global aspect of financial institutions has kind of been helpful. Yeah, so I think it's a kind of a mix of reasons, but I think it is really striking how strong and how resilient the kind of ESG agenda has been so far in financial services.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, a lot of what we hear today is that a lot of, you know, companies are still going on with their sustainability initiatives. They're just not talking about it as much or just going being out there as much. Because ultimately they know it is mission critical that they need to do a lot of these things in order to stay competitive, to shore up their supply chains or be able to, transport materials from one place to another. You know, they all know that that's part of the conversation, whether it be climate change or whatever issue. But, you know, now is not the time to be out there and sticking your neck out, especially here in the U.S. and saying this is our number one priority or even a big priority for us. I think the financial institutions in particular have played it relatively opportunistically. You know, there's just, you know, maybe a handful of banks that have really stepped up from the get-go and said, we want to lead this charge on sustainability or circularity. And, you know, we're committed to it. You know, some of the Dutch banks, you know, an Italian bank, some French banks, you know, they're kind of stepping up on different elements of it and have for some time. But for the most part, I think it is pretty opportunistic in terms of, you know, whether it's on the risk mitigation side, that maybe it's just, you know, if they have a a mortgage team or a business or a home insurance line, they're certainly going to be looking at climate change and applying that. You know, they might not be talking about it externally, but it would be financially irresponsible not to at this point. And then, you know, you have ESG portfolios that have been popping up, and, you know, a number of banks have been getting slapped on the wrist for qualifying those and when they really shouldn't have been green or sustainable ESG portfolios. But there's a lot of them that are just that are doing it right. And they're doing it because they see the opportunity in the market for individual retail investors that do want to put their money where their values are. And so they're responding to that. You know, they're not saying we're going to become an ESG bank, but we're developing these new mutual funds and, you know, ETFs and things like that, that they can then, you know, create more revenue from. So, you know, I think it has been pretty opportunistic. You have seen some financial institutions back away from some of these larger climate committing groups. You know, I think that's really more than anything to buy some political capital here in the U.S. because they're basically saying, you know, there's different states saying we're going to take you out of our pension fund unless you step out of ESG. And they kind of see that as a, you know, relatively simple ticket to unwind those two conversations, even though I think sustainability is embedded into what they're doing and how they work much more than meets the eye.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing, Brendan, which I think you're actually right, especially in North America. We're seeing more people not want to be seen to be backing an ESG agenda as such, but actually the kind of the real economy of financial institutions is based on perception of risk, and they are still operating on the basis that, hey, some stuff's going to go on in the world that's going to mean that, you know, giving a mortgage to a house in certain parts of America is going to be more risky in future years than it is right now. Or, you know, that there's the kind of hard logic of these institutions which still carries on. I think it's interesting to the conversation we're having a minute ago as well around unpacking, you know, sustainability from ESG as such, maybe especially in North America. But in terms of actually, I think the thing that's driven the resilience in financial services is the hard perception of risk rather than the agenda as such. The more people can understand that, the more people start to make hard decisions off the back of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you think about, I mean, financial institutions very tied to the conversation of risk and insurance and reinsurance. And insurance and reinsurance has been talking about climate change for a long time. They're ultimately on the hook for a lot of these catastrophes. And so they've been trying to get insurance companies to say, look, you need to be pricing this a little bit differently. You need to be looking at factoring these models into your prices and how you sell to your customers. And, you know, they have to meet at some point, right? You know, reinsurance has to come to the same understanding as insurance, and insurance has to come to the same understanding with their customers, whether it be financial institutions or others, and everyone has to be more or less on a similar page in understanding what is that level of risk, and how are we going to mitigate that?
I think there's also, it's interesting, there's a kind of misperception in the rest of the world around kind of what's happened from a sustainability or supply chain standpoint in the US. Because I think a lot of the rest of the world has got the idea of backtracking, which is kind of what Josh, you mentioned in the question. And I think it's actually misunderstands what's gone on to some extent, because I think there has been a big, from what we've seen anyway, there's a lot of companies who face pressure around, in inverted commas, the ESG agenda. But what's actually happened is it's not like you can just go back to the way things were before, because actually now every company is more, you know, is more accountable for their supply chain than ever. At the moment, the political pressure is less around ESG and more around Made in America, more around coping with the volatility that's going on in the world.
Yeah.
But you're very much in a space now, in every kind of company of any size, your investors and the media are asking you questions around the whole supply chain and how that all works. And this is not like it was 15 years ago, in the sense of people can kind of say, well, we do this bit of the chain and then we buy from somebody out there. You don't need to worry about it too much. Right now, everyone is just way more accountable for the supply chain than ever. And then you choose how you play that, right? So you're going to get different pressure in different parts of the world at different times. But I just I think there's a real confusion in the rest of the world if they think that Europe and the Middle East is, and Asia is advancing on this ESG agenda and America's going backwards, because it's not going backwards. It's just responding to a different agenda, but with accountability still very much at its heart.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when I was working for WBCSD, it became very clear how loud Americans are. You know, how loud we are on everything. It's hilarious because, you know, being here, it's just the way it is. But you go abroad and you work with some other folks from other areas. Like, man, yeah, we do a lot of talking, a lot more than we should be sometimes. And, you know, as an individual, as, a country, you know, we're very outspoken there. But there's some fantastic things that are going on around the world that are much more progressive on sustainability. And in some cultures, they just don't want to talk about it. They just don't talk about it. You know, they just do it. And you know, in the U.S., a lot of it has been, you know, we're doing some things, but look how great it is. And now, you know, we're still doing those things. We're just not out there talking about it as much. And so I think it just puts the action in a little bit more perspective of, you know, how much action is going on in each of these regions. And to your point, I don't think it's backtracking a whole lot.
It's also interesting, that kind of mood thing as well, because the other thing I pick up, obviously being based in the UK and then speaking to a lot of leaders in Europe, is that I think sometimes Europe has now decided that we're kind of the kind of pioneer of this, or the people driving this, but it's not the case. Like, when we are speaking to leadership teams in the Middle East and in Asia, I was writing this down, because when you were introducing yourself back earlier, Brendan, you were talking about being an architect, going through architecture training and thinking, why wouldn't we build a building that was better for the world? I kind of feel, to your point, in Europe right now, there's a real agenda of communicating the sustainability of the products you're building and the agenda that you're on. When we're speaking to leadership teams in other parts of the world, they're just talking about the future. And it's almost like, why the hell would you not try and make this more sustainable as we go? Because that's going to be what's going to win in future. It's just like there's a real sort of momentum around these things. It's going, it's about building for the future. Of course, you'd make it greener, or, you know, less resource intensive, because that's how you're going to win in the future. I just think it's really interesting. That's definitely just a mood shift that's happened.
Yeah. Having the chance to think down the road like that and where competition will be, you know, eventually, you're always thinking about what's that differentiator going to be. And the bar for even just a license to operate with respect to sustainability is going to go up and up and up, which means, you know, if you want to be a differentiator, you have to think more aggressively than that. And, you know, that doesn't have to be how do we create the most sustainable product by 2030. You know, maybe it's just, how do we ensure we're still a leader at that point, knowing that that ultimate goal is to have a more sustainable product, you know, down the road. But you always have to be calibrated with where the market's at. And you know, whether that's price or performance, it's going to be first and foremost, you know. But if you're too niche, you know, you might not have the same impact that, you know, you might have if you dial it back a little bit, but you're a mass market product, and changing the conversation.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that piece around license to operate, because it's interesting, even if you look at the big AI companies now, really resource intensive, but they are still innovating to try and find ways to reduce that in future. Because to your point, you don't need to be a genius to work out that at some point in the future, their license to operate is going to be highly affected by global perception of the kind of resource intensity of what they're doing. So it's going to, and that's like, if you like, the sector with the most government backing, the most powerful resources at their disposal. So it's like, you know, I think that just people need to get their head around the idea that kind of supply chain accountability is kind of hard coded now. So that whole idea of backtracking, I think it's just really misleading.
Yeah.